And I believe that was June 25th, 1950.
Yes.
I started to work with the Harris Trust in Chicago, then went to the Valley National Bank in Phoenix, and from there was hired by the board as a market expert. I had been trading government bonds for the period between the war and 1950, and they were completely dependent. The board in Washington was completely dependent for market viewpoints on the New York Federal Reserve Bank. And they wanted, this was Winfield Riefler and Woodleaf Thomas, Ralph Young, the top three economists were very anxious to have someone with a market viewpoint down there. So I became chief of the government finance section. And the day after I started, Woody Thomas came down and said, "We've done you a terrible disservice because with the war breaking out, we're in for pegged markets for the duration." And that's the way it looked for a few months. But then in September, we came to a situation in which the Open Market Committee met, and you recall the schedule of interest rates at that time was 3/8% Treasury
right.
bills, 7/8 one-year certificates, up to the 2.5% long-term bonds.
Right.
And the Federal Reserve was monetizing far too much of the debt held by the insurance companies and others. And the decision was made at an open market committee meeting, I'm quite sure it was September, to change the discount rate from 3/4% to 1%. That would have meant that the following week, when the Treasury rolled over a one-year certificate, that it could no longer do it at 7/8%. And the chairman of the Fed then, Tom McCabe, and Alan Sproul, the president of the New York Bank, got in a car, went over to the Treasury, told John Snyder, Secretary of Treasury, that they were planning to do that, and they thought he should know. And before they got back to the Fed, Snyder had pre-announced the refunding at 7/8%, which presumably blocked the Fed. We reconvened the Open Market Committee, and this is my recollection. You'd have to get somebody else's, too. The decision was virtually made immediately that we couldn't do that, at some point I decided to, over the chairman's objection, because he reminded me when I said I would like to make a market observation, and McCabe simply said, "We don't have market opinions down here, Mr. Leach. We depend on the New York Bank for that." Someone else, I don't know who, somebody said, "Well, let's hear what you had to say," or something like that. And I said, "Well, I think there's a way you could resolve this that would probably get some headlines, but it would be a way of declaring our independence. And that is that we go through with the change in the discount rate and simply put in a par bid for all of the new certificates and take a slight loss by selling them or sell something else in the marketplace, and it wouldn't upset the market at all." The best words I ever heard came out of Alan Sproul, said, "I'd like to take about a 10-minute recess and think about that." So he and I talked, at the end, that's that's what we did, and it did cause the breakout in the headlines. You know, Fed defies the Treasury and so forth. But it went through smoothly in the marketplace, and that started the ball rolling that led toward the accord on March 4th of 51, during which time there were all kinds of headlines, stories leaked by particularly Jake Vardaman, who was a member of the board at the time and was had been Truman's aide. And he was, it was clear that he was leaking the stories. It was even virtually proved at a board, at one of the next open market committee meetings. Go into details if you want them.
Oh, sure. This is, I'd love to hear anything you have to say in this. You know, we have a few things. We have Sproul's accounts, and we also have whatever's recorded in FOMC minutes, and Herb Stein has summarized that material. But there's really very little inside discussion of what went on from the accord, except for Alan Sproul's account, and he, you know, published that in the New York Fed Monthly Review, and so, you know, he's very careful, you know, very sort of diplomatic, but
absolutely wonderful guy.
The details of what happened have never been, to my knowledge, and I'm pretty interested in this area, have not been recorded.
Well, I'd love to see that Sproul article if you can manage.
Sure.
Get a copy of it.
Oh, sure. I'll do that.
Okay. Maybe I ought to read that before I talk to you further.
Why don't we talk, and then I'll send you the article, and then we can, if that jogs your memory additionally, we
can... Okay. The incident at the later board meeting, when there's some particularly nasty stories in the American Banker, which were leaked by Vardaman to them. Matt Simchak was vice chairman of the board, and at an ensuing board meeting, I don't know exactly when, it's probably early 51, just after one of the nasty stories had been published, the meeting started, and the chairman always turned to the vice chairman to allow him to say anything he wanted to before the others did. And Simchak said, "I was very disturbed about such and such a story, and I just want to announce publicly or to this group that I have no contact with anyone at the American Banker." And whoever was sitting next to him, another governor, said, "Well, I'm glad to hear that, Matt, and I agree. I have no contact with him. Couldn't possibly have talked to anyone there." Went through one or two more people, and Vardaman, who was the furthest down the line, got up and walked out of the room, and muttering, "I'll be damned if I'm going to go through this kind of thing," or something like that. So it was, there was obvious to everyone where all the anti-Federal Reserve stories were coming from in that respect.
I will. The American Banker is available on microfilm, and I will check these stories. But what was his what was his slant?
Was very much dissension within the board over the fact that the Federal Reserve wasn't giving complete support to the Treasury. The president was upset about it, and I think Truman was probably pretty upset about it. But that's maybe not worthy of being included. What I'm leading up to really is that there was a tremendous amount of undercover work being done. Not to my knowledge, and I think not to the knowledge of almost anyone on the board, including several of the governors. And this was between Winfield Riefler and the Undersecretary of the Treasury, then Bill Martin. And they were, and incidentally, if you can get anything of Win Riefler's, be sure and do it, because he was intending, we were told, he was intending to write a story of this, or write at least a lengthy article that for publication, but it never was published as far as I know.
I've not heard that. Perhaps somebody at the board would know if he has any descendants.
You might know.
Dewey Dane typically has contacts with people. I've talked to him some, and I'll ask him. He may know, but if anything exists, it would have to be with one of his descendants, and I don't know if, you know.
Well, I know one of them very well.
Well,
worked for me at Morgan.
Then
that's Don Riefler, who is just retired, and well, about now he's retired about 2 years ago, I guess.
I've
asked him about it, and he never responded with anything. Whether it was, I don't know whether it existed or he didn't want to reveal it or what.
Do you have either phone number or address for him?
No, but you could get it through my secretary at Morgan.
Okay. Do you have her name?
Yes.
Is she still there?
Yeah, it's Muriel Davis, and the number is part-time Florida, part-time New York, I think now.
And that's Don Riefler.
Donald B. Riefler.
Okay. Definitely. I like to... for these people who are gone, it's also interesting to talk to their descendants, because their sons and daughters, because sometimes they have interesting stories that have been passed down. So I'd love to just give him a call and see what he may have
some
information.
Yeah. But the we went through this long period up to March 4th with more and more feeling of certainty that we were right, and that we were getting full support from a good many articles that were being written, and a feeling of certainty that things were going to work out in our favor. And when the accord came out, of course, we were very happy on March 4th, and then on March 5th, we learned that a presumed enemy, William McChesney Martin, was part of the working out of the accord, and was then appointed chairman of the Federal Reserve. And he succeeded McCabe immediately, because McCabe, it turned out, you've probably got this, had taken the chairmanship of the Federal Reserve with a guarantee to President Truman that he would not allow government bonds to sell below par.
No, that's not part of the...
That's not part of it?
That's not part, and there's absolutely nothing about why McCabe resigned. There's only just complete speculation.
Yes, I know it's speculation, but that's...
Well, I mean in the sense of people who... I mean complete conjecture, not even educated guesses. People typically say, well, he was probably a weak chairman, and Truman probably didn't like him, and Truman fired him. But no one says that with any kind of inside information.
Well, I think everybody who knew the situation closely was confident that that was part of the problem that we were confronted with during the workout toward the accord, is that he was always backing off on maintaining independence, and then maintaining the par level on government bonds. And part of the accord, again, check my facts, part of the accord was that for a period of time, anybody who owned the long-term 2.5% bonds was allowed to swap them for a 5-year 1.5%. which was then selling at or slightly above par.
Yeah, I think that went on for almost a year after March of 51.
I don't know how long it went on, but it was...
About a year, I think. I think the desk was afraid that, given the large amount of securities in the hands of insurance companies and banks, they were afraid that everyone would want out at once.
Mm-hmm.
And then if everybody tried to get out at once, you'd have a big run-up in rates. So they wanted to have a gradual unloading. And that may have been one reason why the monetary policy was so conservative in that time. That the Fed didn't want to scare people.
But there was a big argument within the FOMC on maintaining the price of par on the 1.5s when people started to sell them. And that was finally resolved by letting them break par. But all through this, the New York Fed was very anxiously trying to support at a higher level than the board felt was proper, and the board now including Bill Martin.
You mean after March of 51?
Right. After the exchanges had started, and people started, natural arbitrage would start in a situation like that, but I can't remember exact details, but it seems to me we had a support level at 99.75 for quite some time and allowed far too much liquidation at that time.
Well, I mean, I think the New York desk traders were the ones who really felt under pressure, in that the dealers were consistently wanting them to take more securities than, the New York desk wanted to buy, so it almost became a personal thing where the desk people were put in the position of having to tell these dealers that, well, look, you guys, be patriotic and, do this for your country, and, we don't want to hold them, but the dealers on the other side, kind of viewed it as a personal thing. Well, look, you guys are making the market, we got to sell these, and it's just a business, and you ought to take them. And I think it was an unpleasant, difficult time.
I was up there a lot observing, and thank God for John Larkin, because everybody else wouldn't even speak to me.
Well,
but John was one great guy, sort of a go-between between me and Bob Rouse and...
I gather Rouse was difficult to get along with for everybody. Larkin kind of smoothed things over, although Larkin got in trouble for trying to be an intermediary. But, Rouse kind of wanted everything to go through him. And Larkin was the person people wanted to talk to, because he was so knowledgeable.
Right.
But then he got in trouble when he felt put on the spot a lot.
Well, I don't think he got into trouble, but
he got in trouble with Rouse.
I would say that's the guy that he should have gotten in trouble with, because Rouse simply wanted to maintain the status quo with the, and I can't remember his chief assistant, who was, is it Miller? Is there a guy named Miller in there?
Mm.
Anyway, the...
Later on, it was Bob Stone, but that was...
No, that's long before Stone. Yeah.
No, I don't know that.
Yeah.
Rouse just thought maintain the peg? I mean, he was...
He was for maintaining the pegs and then gradually lowering them and taking only a few bonds here and there. This led to a series of meetings which Bill Martin came to me and talked about leading up to a study of open market operations, which I'm sure you've read. This must have come out in 52. We had the heads of every one of the major dealers come down and spend a day just talking about their relationships to the desk and how they felt markets should operate, and Our big question to them was always, do you guys have enough capital and market ability to operate in a really free market?
Mm-hmm.
Can you stand it? And the answers were all positive, that they were prepared to take chances, take losses. And then finally, the study that came out of all of that, which was largely written, again, I would guess, by Wynn Riefler, talking about depth, breadth, and stability in markets. That phrase comes in quite often. And I didn't realize until later that he was using his son's initials to remind himself of all those words. At least I accused him of that.
That's funny.
But anyway, I'd say that the only event after that that I would think were significant were the ability of the marketplace to step up to their new responsibilities, and then the growing willingness, I guess that's maybe not the right word to use, but the growing acceptance by the Treasury that they had to meet the demands of the marketplace on every one of their offerings and not depend on Federal Reserve support.
No, I say Congress played a part in that too. Were you aware at the time of Senator Douglas and actually Wright Patman? He was no friend of higher interest rates, but
Douglas was disappointing, but Patman was expected, I'd say.
You said Douglas was disappointing? What did you say about Douglas?
Yes, I thought my recollection of Douglas was that he was arguing against the Fed's independence. I may be wrong on that.
He was strong in favor of the getting rid of the peg and establishing Fed independence. So Douglas was a firm believer in the quantity theory. He'd come from the University of Chicago, and he thought money caused inflation, and he thought if the Fed had to buy bonds, it couldn't control money. His metaphor was if you've got a glass and a pitcher of water and you keep pouring water into the glass, it's going to overflow, and that's what's going to happen if you keep buying government securities.
Mm-hmm. I got some other impression along the line. I know that I can't define at this point.
Well, later on in the 60s, I think he was much more critical of the Fed and Fed raising rates in 66.
Yeah.
I think your impressions may come from that later period when he was attacking the Fed. But at that time, he was very supportive.
I should add that I'm from the University of Chicago, too.
Oh, so am I.
Oh, really?
Oh, dear. I wrote my thesis under Milton Friedman.
Oh, for goodness sake. We'll get to that one in a minute. Let me say the one thing that always disappointed me was that the conclusion of our study included the statement that the Federal Reserve should not try to influence the price levels of longer-term securities, that their responsibility should rest with the quantity theory, and that therefore they should buy only securities due within a year and just let the market decide what the quantity of money that was being created should dictate in terms of the rest of the yield curve. And the New York Fed characterized that as the bills only policy, and got enough support from the feeling that we at the Fed were being far too restrictive, and that there would be a time when the Federal Reserve should intervene in the market. Well, the accord or the study result included that, but included a statement which originally was that they should maintain stability in the market. And that meant to the New York bank, to the desk, that they could intervene at will. But we changed that instruction. You've probably seen this in the minutes of the FOMC.
Yes.
Changed that to correcting disorderly markets rather than preventing. In other words, you could say any time, well, we went in because we thought that the market would become disorderly.
Mm-hmm.
And our answer in Washington was, when the market becomes disorderly, you do something about it, but you don't decide beforehand that you're going to prevent it. It's maybe a little difficult in terms of writing it, but everybody understood what we were talking about, and yet, well, again, for a personal story, I'd been up at the up in New York. I went up there in 1953 with the Guaranty Trust, and then the merger with Morgan at Morgan Guaranty. And the one of the wonderful things about that was a continuing contact with Alan Sproul at the New York Bank, and after he retired, fairly regular visits when he would come in for lunch with a number of us. And in the early 60s, when Kennedy was elected, appointed Dillon Secretary of the Treasury and Bob Rosa the Undersecretary, here was the arch enemy, Bob Rosa, who had been fighting against any restrictions on open market operations. And at one of the luncheons when Alan Sproul was in at the bank, everybody walked out of the lunchroom, and he held my arm, and as we walked down the aisle together, he whispered, "I want you to know that BO is dead." And this was the story that came out of that was that when Dillon was appointed Secretary of the Treasury, he and Rosa were the only ones who knew Kennedy. Bill Martin hadn't even met the president. So at some session, this subject was brought up, that the Fed had its hands tied as far as the operations of the government bond market were concerned. And it was because of this Bill's only policy. And Sproul had just heard from Rosa that as a result of that luncheon, Bill Martin agreed to abandon that stance. But for a while, they were operating only in the very short-term market as far as the desk was concerned.
Yes, that I know a little bit about that. That was partly in response to pressure from the Council of Economic Advisors. The Council wanted lower interest rates,
uh-huh.
And the kind of compromise that was reached was that the Fed would have flexibility to move short-term rates, but they would have to purchase long-term bonds to try to lower long-term rates. So it was.
What was the date of that? You recall or that?
Yes, I do. It would have been early 61.
Yeah.
It was in a part it was a strategy to defuse pressure to keep short-term rates low. Basically, what the Treasury and Rosa were saying, okay, you know, if you'll give the Fed some flexibility on short-term rates, you know, we'll do what we can for you on the long-term end. So,
uh-huh.
It was partly a tactical thing. But let me get back to this earlier. I found it fascinating that you were working at the board, and yet, at least personally, you sided with Sproul on the bills only issue. Did that come from your earlier experience in the bank?
Sproul was on the opposite side.
Yeah, Sproul was opposed to bills only. But what I'm saying is that you were at the board, and at least personally, you sided with New York on this issue. Was that because of your earlier experience as a bond trader?
I'm sorry, I did not side with the New York view, no. Oh. I was for the bills only policy. I was the one who put it in there.
Oh, go over that again, because then I missed it. I thought you were sympathetic with Sproul's opposition to bills.
I was for free markets, period. And a decision to restrict the operations to the short-term market would have fitted in with a free market policy. Once you try to say, well, we'll muddy this up a little bit, do whatever we want on short-term rates and money supply, but at the same time, we'll support some level of rates that the market doesn't believe in, then you're in trouble. And
Okay, good. I'm glad you cleared that up. But Sproul had this idea that if you did operations at the short end, it might take a long term for the reserves to make their way to the long end.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just
that's quite possible.
A judgment with him.
But it's still not an artificial market.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm just trying to get inside.
Yeah.
Try to understand how Sproul viewed this. Can we talk about Sproul for a minute, since you had contact with him later on also? I've talked to a number of people who knew him, but always in administrative relationships.
Mm-hmm.
They worked for him, and they really had they don't have much idea of kind of how he thought about things. Did you get a sense of his feeling of kind of what he thought, say, caused the depression and, the appropriate role of the Federal Reserve System and how that changed over time? Kind of any sense of larger issues of kind of how his view of monetary policy differed from Martin's, and if Sproul had remained the kind of dominant force within the system, would monetary policy have been different? I mean,
yes and no. I think that one of the most significant things between the two of us, between Alan Sproul and Ralph Leach, was a statement when we adopted the policy of operating in the short-term market only and let the market decide what the curve should be. Walking out of that meeting, he said, and this must have been before I left the Federal Reserve, and he said, "Ralph, you'll regret this one day. What you're doing is taking the setting of monetary policy away from the financial center of the world in New York and moving it to Washington." And I said, "I know that, Alan, but that's got to come inevitably. You're not going to be able to keep that kind of relationship." And he says, "We'll talk about it." And we did over the years, and he asked me several times if I didn't regret some of the things that had been done and some that I had supported strongly, and I said no. I still think it was inevitable. The country would not have taken New York as the center of the Federal Reserve System for any longer period than they did. I still feel certain about that, and I think I got that from Bill Martin, probably, because we not only had a good working relationship with his market background and mine, but we happened to play tennis every noon.
Oh, you must have been a great tennis player.
Yeah.
Oh, you must have been very athletic.
I don't think
I would play tennis with Bill Martin today. So there were two issues here. One is where the dominant influence within the system was going to lie. As long as you had the executive
main one that I would was contesting with Alan, but on the broader issues, I really don't think I'd be able to comment.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Sproul wanted to conduct monetary policy through tone and feel of the markets, kind of being right there, almost minute by minute to see how markets were reacting and then responding in a intuitive way. And Martin was more, even though he was not an economist, he was more of a person who would look at economic statistics, what his staff was telling him about the economy. And so there was, in a sense, this is probably not the right word, but Martin was more of a modern, Sproul went back more to kind of Depression era policy making, and Martin had kind of one foot in each camp, and but one of those feet was in the, kind of the more modern kind of quantitative look at all the incoming statistics on the economy.
Well, I think there was another aspect of it, though, and that is that you look back through the presidents of the New York Fed, and I think Alan was saying, in effect, that these guys were much better position to view the world picture and to translate that to foreign central bankers than anybody who had ever been appointed chairman of the Fed.
Well, in a sense, that was right in that the New York Fed was always more concerned about the dollar.
Right.
Through the end of Al Hayes's period, it was the New York Fed was more consistently willing to raise interest rates when the dollar was under attack than the board. Although, I'm sure the board's judgment of the situation that the country wasn't willing to run domestic monetary policy on the basis of international considerations was undoubtedly the better, or in a sense, the more politically correct judgment.
And Alan brought that up every once in a while. You see how the Washington the dominance of Congress and the President over the Federal Reserve, which might not have been true if New York had maintained its premier position.
Well,
anyway, who knows?
I mean, the issue is whether, regardless of how the struggle for influence within the system had been resolved, whether the congressional banking committees would have been willing to let New York, as opposed to the board, run policy. I mean, I think the answer is clear that Congress wants people close by. It thinks it can, anyways.
You mentioned Milton Friedman. I became a great advocate of his, although I never took any courses from him. He was later time than I, but I got to know him quite well through the Oppenheimer relationship that he had.
Oh, he still has that?
Huh?
He still has a relationship.
I know he's close to Chuck Bruni. Chuck might be a good guy for you to talk to if you haven't.
I've actually had a couple letters from him, but on different sorts of things, on indexing government bonds and so on.
Let me just relate one incident that shortly after I had left the Fed, maybe it was in 1955 or thereabouts, whoever was dean of the school at Chicago then invited me out to give a talk to a banking school in Wisconsin. And he picked me up at the airport and drove me up, and he said, I don't know whether you know much about Milton Friedman. And I said, well, I've heard the name, but I don't know him. And he said, well, let me tell you, he is the world's greatest logician. But if you get into a debate with him, don't grant him any of his premises. You challenge his premise, his logic. Well,
that's very insightful.
We got up to this meeting, and my talk was to be on Federal Reserve operations, and I went through a lot of the discussion that you and I have just had, and said that Well, one of the most interesting things to me was that none of the economists there really had any idea how markets worked. And I taught a class in how markets work. And one of the things that I did was to point out a way, a graphic way, of how Federal Reserve interference in the market just kills a market at any given time. And at the end of the talk, Milton, who was sitting in the front row, stood up and he said, "I just want to say you have taught me how to teach a course in a way that I've never taught it before." And wow. He and I became really quite good friends over the years, but he was always, I thought, a champion of free markets that really stood out in a way that nobody else has.
Well, what we forget now is what the intellectual environment was, and
right.
how difficult it was in an academic environment to defend free markets, even though the country as a whole was fairly conservative. In academia, it was, you were all by yourself if you were willing to defend the market. What he did took an enormous amount of courage.
If they hadn't had a market person on their side, and the New York Fed was not filling that role, they would have ended up losing to the Treasury and just going on supporting the market.
So you provided the intellectual rationale for what had to be done.
Right.
And the New York Fed was on,
statement, though,
I mean, the New York Fed was on the firing line, in a sense. I mean, the New York Fed had the sense that it was creating too many reserves. It knew what the problem was in a practical way, but it couldn't articulate it. Let me go back to the accord in the discussions within the FOMC. It was an unusual situation in the sense that ordinarily the chairman is the dominant person, and yet on the FOMC at the time, the two dominant individuals must have been Eccles and Sproul rather than the chairman. And Sproul and Eccles were then the driving force behind this, and how did they work together? Did they see things the same way, and they just kind of worked together on this?
I'd find it difficult to answer that question. My sessions with Eccles were just ones where he would go on for a couple of hours just dissecting every statement I made and saying, "Are you sure you feel certain about that?" and so forth. Sproul was a much smoother guy, and I think the one thing that I wish I could remember, and you've probably got a good memory of it, was his caucusing with all of the Federal Reserve Bank presidents on some point, and it must have been on the question of restricting operations to the short term area. Does that come to your mind anywhere that I think he had them all meet in Richmond.
I think that was after the accord, wasn't it? That
I can't remember, but I was trying to.
My recollection is that there was a meeting in Richmond. The study you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and that was presented to the full FOMC, the regional bank presidents, and that was done at Richmond. And I would guess, this is just my guess, that what you're talking about, the caucusing would have occurred at that time. But that was That was later on. I'd have to check that, but almost maybe early 53 or.
Well, yeah, my recollection is that to some extent drove a wedge between Eccles and Sproul. That Eccles, but that's too vague a recollection. I wouldn't want to. I could urge you to try to read more about it, but that's all.
Sure. What can you tell me about Eccles, your recollections or impressions of him? I've never talked to anyone who personally knew or had any contact with Eccles.
Well, I would say that I really didn't have much contact with him in the aftermath of, I think it must have been the decision to throw down the gauntlet to the Treasury at the very, very outset in September of 50, that Woodleaf Thomas came down to my office and said, Governor Eccles would like you and me to come up and talk to him. And as we left the office, he said, turned to my secretary and he said, call Mrs. Leach and tell him he'll be late for dinner about 4 o'clock.
Yeah.
Sure enough, we spent from about 4 to, I think, about 7. And he was just going over every aspect of what we had talked about, and he was desperately trying to be convinced that although he had voted for what we did, he was uneasy, I'd say.
He was
That
a.
doesn't give you any feeling
No,
for
but it
Eccles.
does. He was a banker by background.
Yeah,
So
so they.
it was harder for him to think in the kind of general, I guess, macroeconomic way that, I mean,
But he had been in the cabinet position somewhere or what? I can't remember. Was he, or was the Federal Reserve appointment right out of the Salt Lake background?
right out of Salt Lake, and he was a political confidant of Roosevelt. So he was really a New Dealer by profession, and he was not an economist. And he accepted the views of the time that the Depression had been caused by speculation, the overextension of credit, and there really wasn't much the Fed could do about it except try to kind of reestablish. Extension of credit. So of course he had no kind of background in Chicago quantity theory or whatever. But
No.
I mean, he was kind of banker, New Dealer. But I think he must he didn't get along with Truman, and since Truman didn't reappoint him,
All right.
so I think he didn't lose any love on over Truman, and I think he probably, believed that the Fed ought to be independent. But I think he probably had a pretty vague. I assume the driving force behind all this was that the Fed thought it was going to create inflation by pegging the rates. But he probably had only a vague idea of how that would work.
Yeah, but there was a feeling that he felt he was going to be appointed chairman, and I never understood that. But I think he was hurt internally when Bill Martin came over from the Treasury to succeed McCabe.
I hadn't heard that. I wouldn't have thought, given the relation between Eccles and Truman, I wouldn't have thought that he would have.
I would have thought if anybody was, it would have been Matt Simchak. Political tie. I always felt he had a good political tie to Truman.
Simchak
And
was
this is just an impression, but
well connected politically, but no one has ever had anything good to say about him as an intellect or a leader.
that's true. Yeah.
He certainly didn't impress anybody as far as his leadership or
no,
intellectual capabilities
yeah.
Go. So, just one detail. So, why do you think McCabe left? Do you think the decision was made to make Martin chairman, and then Truman, you know, simply asked him to leave?
My understanding, and I'd say this was this. I'm surprised you haven't heard it from others. If you
well, there aren't too many.
Them you can't talk to.
Yeah, there aren't a lot of others talking about this period. And most of the other people who were in the Fed at this period, like Dewey Dane, were really young. You know, they were just kind of staff people.
That's right.
Young
Dewey
people,
and
they weren't connected. That's right.
My understanding was that McCabe, while all this talk was going on about what we were going to do vis-a-vis the Treasury market, that he was quietly saying to himself, I can't let this happen. I've promised the president I wouldn't. And there was a good reason why Truman had that strong feeling after based on his World War I experiences. That when the accord was reached and it was understood that some treasuries would be falling below par, that Tom walked over to Truman's office and said, I would like you to accept my resignation. And there was, I don't know how the appointment of Martin came about. I wouldn't have guessed that this was something that was obvious to a lot of people in the administration, that here was a guy who was a perfect candidate for the chairmanship, and
I don't really know.
At some levels within the administration for some time.
So McCabe probably felt like he could no longer lead the Fed.
Yeah, he'd lost.
Yeah. I just read odds and ends about Martin's appointment. Apparently Snyder was away in the hospital, so Martin conducted the negotiations and impressed both sides. And Anderson, who later became Secretary of the Treasury under Anderson, who was from Texas, apparently brokered the agreement and persuaded Truman that Martin would be a good chairman. But those are just odds and ends of things that I've read. I've not no one has given me their own account, personal accounts of it. Can you tell me a little bit about the individuals at the board that were, you know, one step below the FOMC and the executive committee, and how they looked at things? I mean, how did people view the Fed's relationship to inflation, and how did they see the relationship between pegging bond rates and the inflation rate, and the consequences of continuing the peg?
Well, I think the reason I was hired was that they had strong feelings that the peg, and by they, I would say the trio at the top, Wynn Riefler, Woodley Thomas, and Ralph Young, all felt strongly that they were being the tools of inflation, and that had to be broken, but that they didn't feel that they were expressing themselves, apparently, in FOMC meetings. Maybe not. Maybe just a feeling that nobody would contradict Alan Sproul, that was the basis. Woody Thomas was the one who came out to Phoenix and offered me the job.
Well, how did they know about you?
through dealers in New York. They apparently had some contact with... the dealers would come down and talk to people at the Fed all the time, and never learning much of anything, but trying to tell the Fed that lots of dealers felt that the market would do a hell of a lot better with the Fed stepping away from it.
Hmm.
That'd be a better indicator to the economy of what interest rates really should be.
So your expertise came from your background, what you'd learned at Chicago, or from what you'd learned, figured out on your own when you were in the markets?
I started sitting out in the Pacific for 2.5 years in the Marine Corps that there was so much public debt being created that when I went back to the bank, there was going to be a good thing to get involved in. It's going to be a major part of the banking business, which it hadn't been. And it was true. There was practically every head of every major bank's portfolio operation in the post-war years was an ex-banker who had been moved in simply because that had become such a large part of the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And I moved in with no background at all, but a feeling that there could be a real opening for young people in that area. So that was it. And luckily, it traded very successfully both in Chicago and Phoenix, and thereby got a little reputation among the dealers in New York, none of whom I had ever met because Phoenix was too remote to to visit.
I'm sure it was that in 1950. Yeah. What can you tell me about Riefler, Young, and Thomas? I mean, those are names that for sure I know. You can't read anything about the Fed without coming across those names all the time. Yet I've never talked to anyone who knew them personally.
Well, Wynn Riefler was a standout. I think probably one of the great economists of the century.
Mm-hmm.
And the other two were very strong, but not in his class. Would be my judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But Wynn was the guy who invented the mortgage. Stretched out mortgage payments as opposed to single payments, which were the one of the very weak things that helped the Depression get a lot worse. That was his invention that brought about the 20-year, 25-year mortgage payments.
And when was that? When
well, that must have been in the early 30s.
Hmm.
Again, I've always, everybody attributed that to him. There was probably a group of people who led that effort, but I would bet if there were a group that he was the key man in it.
Mm-hmm. He must have had a fair amount to do with the introduction of free reserves targeting. The New York Fed didn't like those initially. I mean, they wanted to use tone and feel, unless they didn't want a quantitative guideline. But that was the board's idea, right? And I mean, Riefler must have had something to do with free reserves.
I really don't know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm. Woody Thomas handled statistical briefings and kind of information on the economy. He wasn't really an economist, but he's more kind of a statistician.
Young, was really the head of that division, and Jack Noyes under him was the guy that I worked most with. And then brought to Morgan Guaranty when I got up there. He was chief economist for Morgan Guaranty for a number of years. My contact was mostly with Wynn, and particularly discussing market developments. He was more interested in that. This was undoubtedly his continuing relationship with Bill Martin.
Mm-hmm.
So I may be influenced by that in my feeling that he was of considerably greater stature than the other two.
And he must have been an important influence in the Accord in supporting the abolition of the interest rate peg. I mean, he must have been a dominant.
Worked out most of the details, I'd say, with Bill Martin, who was then at the Treasury.
So he was probably the primary staff person negotiating with
the
Treasury.
I would think the only.
Excuse me?
I would think the only staff person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on Martin's side, my impression is that it was a two-man deal, and they got along beautifully, and they were working toward the same goal, a real market.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was not anything that depended on a lot of staff support at either side.
Hmm.
It was just
the
impression. Now, it could be that Woody Thomas and Ralph Young had tremendous input. Excuse me just one second.
Sure.
1:00. 1:00. Sorry. Yeah. Excuse me.
Martin's father was governor of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, so there must have been that connection that must have contributed.
Right.
I've been told that Martin kept a diary, but the family is unwilling to make it public. So hopefully that will be preserved, and
mm-hmm.
some year people will get an insight into all these things.
But that's a shame that they wouldn't release it.
Well, apparently people have tried to, a few people know about it, and they've
mm-hmm.
tried to persuade him to put it in a library or
yeah.
something, and the family's unwilling to do it, so nobody really knows what's going to happen, but
is
hopefully
his widow
someday,
still living?
They're both still living, but he's no longer coherent.
Oh, I know. I thought he died last year.
No, he's still alive, and his wife is still lucid, capable,
mm-hmm.
but he's no longer able to talk with people.
Yeah.
So he's just in a nursing home, but more than that, I don't really know. Do you have any sense of the big event of this time, the Accord? Truman was unpopular at the time. He was kind of low in the, these
uh-huh.
public opinion polls, and the Fed was getting some support from Congress. Yet it's extraordinarily unusual for the Fed to risk a showdown with the President of the United States. Do you have any sense that the FOMC kind of calculated, well, yeah, we can win this one? I mean, what happened was really an amazing thing. There must have been a lot of trepidation.
I knew they were taking a calculated risk, and going back to the three-hour session with Eccles, that was clearly what that was all about. He had to have every detail, every argument that he could possibly use, because he was going to be badgered over the next week or two with a hell of a lot of people asking what the hell is going on over there. You're talking about the break in 1950 now.
Right.
Yeah. And, yes, I think they were well aware that they were taking a big calculated risk. But it was something they had to do.
And after the full FOMC met with Truman, they came back to the board and had a meeting. And there's no record of that. That was not part of the FOMC meetings.
Really?
Yeah, at one point, I think maybe it was the day after that, Eccles, the FOMC agreed on a statement as to what had happened at their understanding of, what had happened at the meeting with Truman. And, of course, there was the famous incident of then Eccles, on his own initiative, released that to the public, and of course it showed the FOMC had no intention of continuing the peg on long-term bonds. But the initial meeting after the of the FOMC after meeting with Truman, there's no record of that meeting.
I never did see FOMC minutes on a regular basis. I could get them if I asked, but.
Do you remember the incident where Eccles, on his own initiative, released the board's memorandum?
I remember that. But that was sort of a short-lived burst, seemed to me.
Mm-hmm.
At least that was. But that you've gone back into the motives of a lot of these, and I wouldn't know anything about them. I was sort of floating in a different world. I was just obviously badgered by thousands of calls from New York, which I just couldn't answer. After the March 4th accord was reached, the New York Bank called a meeting either on Saturday or Sunday of the heads of all of the major government security dealers, and I flew up to New York for that to talk about what was expected as far as I could tell them from the tenor of what had gone on at the meetings. Simply that we expected them to conduct the market without any support from the Fed, and how soon could they do it, and how much trouble were we in from a capital standpoint, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd had a long talk with Wynn about that, and I can't remember either. I guess it was Woody Thomas and I went up, not Wynn. Woody was available, but he went along to talk sort of philosophically. You never met him, I gather.
No.
Very soft-spoken Southern voice, and then he would turn to me and say, "Well, you know their language better than I," something like that, and of course we had. Bob Rouse and the staff, John Larkin and others, were there.
Mm-hmm.
You've probably gotten some different impressions than I would have had from that. My feeling was that the group of dealers welcomed it. Chris Devine, I remember, particularly strongly saying, "We've got plenty of capital. We've been frustrated for years with doing business on a basis that is not a market basis." And,
When did you leave the Fed?
1953.
Mm-hmm. So, early, late 53, or
September, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. There was a recession going on at that time, and end of 53 and early 54, and the Fed pushed interest rates down to quite low levels by the middle of 54.
Prime rate was at 3% about spring in 54.
Yeah, and the 3-month bill rate got down to almost 0.5% in June of 54. Later on, Martin said that he thought the Fed overdid it, that it was too, we came out of the recession too quickly, monetary policy was too expansionary. Do you remember anything of those?
Very well. For a personal reason, that I was still a young kid at this time, the chairman of the Old Guaranty Trust was really a tough old oil man type, and at a meeting. meeting, it was probably April or May of 54, I was head of the portfolio committee, and I said, I would suggest we sell all of our long-term bonds, confine our holdings within 2 or 3 years at the most. And the chairman says, why? Just sort of shocked, why? I said,
yeah.
Well, because interest rates are going to go up. And he said, how much? And I said, well, prime rate will probably go to 5% from 3. He said, you've got a bet. My bet's always $2. I said, okay, I'll take it. And we set a time, a period of 18 months. And each succeeding meeting, discussion would come up again, and he'd say, I can double my bet any time, and you can either pay me now or take the double. So we doubled it to $4.60.
Yeah,
this
funny.
Time my associates were telling me, look, Luther Cleveland hates to lose a bet, so you better, for God's sake, hope you lose that bet.
That's funny.
It got to $32. And he went abroad in something like August of 55.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chase raised the rate to 5%. And everybody looked at me and said, kid, you're in trouble. And when he went to the bank, just 8:30 in the morning, his secretary came down with a note that just says, congratulations, young man, with $32 with it. Not a word was ever said about it. So, yes, indeed, I remember that.
Well, did you follow monetary policy then?
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
I just going back, I had the feeling that that experience was important. For example, in 1959, when the Fed again pushed interest rates very low in 59.
But yeah.
When bond rates went way down then way back up, they got concerned that they were going to repeat that earlier period. And Martin began to push short-term rates up very sharply throughout 59,
yeah.
Partly out of concern. He didn't want to repeat the earlier experience. And monetary policy ended up being very tight that year.
Yeah. Yeah, there were lots of fairly violent swings, but I think mostly it's all been to the good as far as the economy is concerned.
Well, the Fed kept the inflation rate down in the 50s.
So, right.
But then the Fed had the executive committee when you left, as opposed to the regular FOMC meetings. The FOMC only met, I guess, the full FOMC met 4 times a year, and the executive committee met once every several weeks.
Right.
Do you remember these questions are very general. I'm running to the end.
But this is after I left. Most.
Yeah, I guess.
Well, let me say one thing that might add to your knowledge on this. That about a month or so after Bill Martin came in as chairman. I was walking off the tennis court with him one day, and he had just had a meeting of some group, whichever, I don't know, but he said, Ralph, would it scare you to think of a president sometime in the future or a Congress who might call all of the Federal Reserve presidents and the board to a congressional hearing and to think of what some of these people might be saying to those congressmen? And I said, Bill, I don't even know most of the people you're talking about, so I wouldn't know how to react, but But in effect, what he was saying was that that clearly there had to be a much greater dissemination of information to a broader group than they were then reaching, and an understanding and an agreement, or open disagreement, if you want to show that there can be dissension in a board. But I know he started very soon after that to broaden as quickly as he could the participation and still not disrupt things too much, because you can't spend all your time in board meetings.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting observation. I've got to ask you this before we quit. So what years were you at Chicago?
I graduated in 1938.
Mm-hmm. So did you have any contact with Frank Knight, for example?
No. The guy that I knew best in the faculty was Ted Eindema, who I became a good friend later, because he was head of, he left Chicago to become, financial vice president of Ford Motor. And he ran he was the contact that we had on their pension fund, and he was the guy who put
Hello? I'm sorry, I missed the... Shit.
I think Chuck Bruni could tell you more about this if you're interested, that he was the one who pushed the pension fund managers into using stocks. Up until then, I know the Guaranty Trust, when Eindema said, I want you guys to start buying stocks instead of all these goddamn bonds you're buying, said, well, you have to write us a letter of indemnification to protect us, or something like that. Hard to believe, isn't it? It's 40 years ago, but I'm quite sure that Eindema was the key guy in that movement.
Do you remember anything about what your professors were saying about the Depression at the time? Did you get any strong feelings about, you know, a Chicago view of the Depression? Was it debated vigorously, or?
I'm surprised I remember as many of the things that I've just told you about in the last hour. No, I couldn't remember any of that.
Yeah. What, you mentioned Chuck Bruni a couple times. I've actually had a little correspondence with him on things that Milton Friedman has kind of intermediated between us, index bonds and some things like that. But what was your connection with him?
Well, he's a close personal friend in Bronxville when he lived in New York. He did a write-up on Ted Eindema when he died. What is the group that meets in conservative economist Milton Friedman, the Mont Pelerin?
Yes.
Is that it?
Yes.
Chuck Bruni wrote an article on him. What do you call it? Not a eulogy, but a memorial sort of thing. And in it, he had a footnote I guess it was my relationship with Ted Eindema, and a footnote that says Milton Friedman has written or has said that the major person involved in the accord between the Treasury and the Federal Reserve was Ralph Leach. And this was news to me. But then he went on to say that this may not be too surprising, since Ralph was one of Ted Eindema's students at the University of Chicago.
Hmm.
So.
Well, did Bruni ever have any relationship with the Fed, or?
No, no.
Yeah.
No.
Mm-hmm.
But he is a personal friend of Milton's and Alan Greenspan.
Oh.
In fact, the greatest dinner I ever attended in my life was one that four people, Chuck Bruni, had invited Milton and Alan Greenspan, and Milton's son.
Yeah, David.
David and I were...
spirited comedy.
All I did was sit, and all Chuck did was sit and listen.
Yeah, spirited conversation, I'm sure.
Right.
John Larkin mentioned Dick Youngdahl.
Dick Youngdahl, yeah.
What was his position?
Dick was my boss, my immediate boss at the Fed.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of those, as I recall, who suggested that we have some sessions in which probably seven or eight of the economists, Jack Noyes, Dick, and others, and I would explain how markets operate to them. In fact, I used a game theory, a game approach to it that had them trading with each other, and then I'd stop the trading and tell them, look, you can't do that. You can't make a market that has a 7 bid offered at 10, not when the markets are normally trading in 8 or 1/4 point spreads.
Mm-hmm.
So you simply can't make a market like that. But some guy would get into, one of them would get into a position where he didn't know whether he wanted to buy or sell, so he'd just spread his markets, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of fun doing that. And,
I mean, you were basically explaining how markets, through
operate.
Supply and demand, set prices, and that market would work like any other market.
Yeah, and you did numbers to them, and the sum of the numbers was what the closing market was going to be, and nobody knew what it was. But anyway, the point I'm getting at is that I knew Dick had a lot of interest in that, and I went up to New York in 1953, and Aubrey Lansden knew that he did not have long to live, and he called me and offered me the job of presidency of the firm and succeed him whenever he was no longer able. And I told him I did not want the job, but let me tell you who is a good guy to talk to, and he hired Dick, and Dick had a long, and I'm sure, very successful career at Aubrey Lansden.
Would you have a phone number or address for him?
No, I'm not sure where he is.
Well, I can send a letter to Aubrey Lansden, so I'm sure they would. I'm sure they would forward it.
Oh, in fact, David Jones, does that name mean anything to you?
No.
He's an economist at Lansden and Company that Dick hired. He was very.
Oh yes, I know the
Dick
name.
Hired him, and he's still.
Sure.
Well, he's every Friday morning at 6:30. You'll see him on.
Sure, sure, sure.
CNN Business News. He's the economist now for Lansden. If he would know, you could get in touch with him, and I'm sure he knows where Dick is.
Okay, that's good advice, and I'll call your secretary Muriel Davis about Don Riefler, and I'll send you the things that Sproul wrote about the Accord. And after reading those, if you have any more, if that jogs your memory at all, I'd love to hear from you.
Hey, I'll be glad to.
Okay, well, this has been wonderful. I've just certainly enjoyed this.
And if you have any questions that you think of, give me another call.
Oh, absolutely. Well, thanks
Thank
again.
You. Bye.
Bye.